From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The nature writer David Gessner had a plan for a journey. The idea was to get back to the West, where he'd once lived and fallen in love with. But he also wanted to return to the two writers who had helped him make sense of the region, Wallace Stegner and Edward Abbey. Preparing for his journey, he went back and read as much as he could of their work, the novels, the essays, even the letters and journal entries. And he wondered if Abbey and Stegner weren't outdated, given the new challenges of the new West, climate change and energy development and sprawl. But what he says he came to realize is that, in fact, they've never been more relevant, and that their books, he believes, can serve as guides for the future of the West. Today in the program, David Gessner is joining us to explain what he learned. His book is called All the Wild That Remains, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer David Gessner is joining us to talk about his new book, which is a journey of sorts. In one sense, it's an actual journey to understand the writers Edward Abbey and Wallace Stegner. He uses the New West as a setting. It's, of course, a place of growth and drought and drilling. And Gessner explores his own relationship with wild places by comparing the writing and the lives of Stegner and Abbey. He's particularly interested in what these writers would say about conditions today. And in some ways, it could be said they predicted them. The book is called All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. David Gessner teaches creative writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where he founded the literary journal Ecotone. His previous books include Return of the Osprey and My Green Manifesto. And he's joining us today from the studios of NPR member station WHQR in Wilmington. And David Gessner, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's been a while since we talked. I think it was about 8 years ago we talked about My Green Manifesto.
Yeah, I actually want to come back to that a little bit as we go along. Well, let's start with the initial idea. When did you start thinking about wanting to return to the West? And I guess I'm wondering which came first, the journey to the West or the Wallace Stegner Edward Abbey part? What was the idea, the initial idea?
Well, I pretty much wanted to get back out west ever since I left, which was now 18 years ago.
Right.
I was born in a very unwestern city, Worcester, Massachusetts, and I had a rough 30th year of my life, during which I found out I had testicular cancer and had a very depressing kind of urban existence there. But I did one good thing during that year, and that was I applied to grad schools in creative writing. I always tell my students to stay hopeful because I got rejected by 5 of those schools, and I got into the 6th, and it just happened to be in Boulder, Colorado. And I found that out during the course of radiation treatment. So I always say it's like the deus ex machina of my life.
Right.
I kind of broke my life into a before and after, and I was basically airlifted, metaphorically at least, from Worcester, Mass. To El Dorado Springs, Colorado, a little north of south of Boulder. And it was just unbelievable. I mean, it's the cliche of kind of renewal in the West. I was healthy again, and I soon learned that in Boulder, Colorado, it's required by law that you be in good shape. So I started turning my walks into runs. I started to read the West as well as be in the West. And I'd read a little Abbey before, probably when I was 28. But here at 30, I was kind of rediscovering him and reading him more fully as I got healthier in this beautiful place. I don't know if you've ever been to El Dorado Springs, but it's, you know, it fits its name of El Dorado.
Right.
It's kind of paradise. And so I would read and reread Desert Solitaire with great lines like, "On this bedrock of animal faith, I take my stand," or "Simply breathing in a place like this arouses the appetite." And I really felt this kind of comeback thing. And as I say in the book, Abbey became kind of a gateway drug to Stegner. and to other Western writers. I mean, I can't think of a more relevant writer right now than Mark Reisner in Cadillac Desert. And so it led me into, you know, I say in the book that there are many kinds of Western converts, but I was both the physical one and a literary one. And so I started reading these guys. And I never, you know, when I moved back east 7 years later, I took them with me in a way.
Right.
And I used them to think about Cape Cod, where I was originally from, and, well, Worcester, but I hide that. I took them to think about Massachusetts, and now that I live in North Carolina, I use them to think about the geography here and the vulnerability to hurricanes. So they've always been with me in their different ways ever since I discovered them personally at around 30.
You ask early on in the book, would Stegner or Abbey be surprised at the West, at what the West has become? Let's talk a little bit about the conditions of the West now that you are, I think that it in part seemed to motivate you to want to write about how those two writers may have responded to it. I mean, in some ways you could say nothing's changed. Still energy development is a challenge, still the question of aridity and drought. But is there something new that you're seeing on the landscape
of the
West?
Well, it's the elephant in the room. It's the something new is climate change. And a lot of people think about climate change affecting places like where I am, where 6 inches of sea level rise are going to swamp us, basically.
Yeah.
But arid places, I mean, this sounds almost simple to the point of tautology, but the driest places are going to be the most affected because they can't tolerate that edge of dryness. But as you said, on the one hand, there's nothing new. Stegner, who really started formulating, I mean, he was born in 1909, so he starts formulating these ideas, before he's like 24. And his ideas are, this Western place is really a desert or near desert. Everyone's calling it something else, but this is what it is.
Yeah.
It tends to have human beings who come in, get something and get out, whether that's the mountain men and the beavers or the buffalo or silver or gold or oil or fracking or tourism.
Yeah.
You know, it tends to be a boomer, as he put it, society.
A resource colony is how you put it.
Yeah, a resource colony, which is funny because I use the same phrase. My previous book was about the Gulf oil spill. And my book came out on Monday, which was the anniversary of the spill. And I was really comparing it, the two places, and thinking about how Stegner would think about the oil spill too in that way. But so he had this big picture view of the West, and he kind of advocated for what he called stickers versus boomers, people who went to a town, stayed there, made something out of it, and didn't run off. Of course, the great anti-model for this was his father, George Stegner,
right.
The first big book he had, Big Rock Candy Mountain, alludes to the fact that George Stegner was always looking for the next score, always looking over the next hill, always on the move. And Stegner really spent his whole childhood on the move following his father's dreams, whereas his mother, a sticker, fought against that but always lost, really, to his more powerful and bullying dad.
Was it Wendell Berry who pointed out to you, or maybe this was something you learned by yourself, that his mother, Wallace Stegner's mother, always planted perennials?
That was her hope. You know, there's a whole fascinating, if we had another hour to talk, a whole fascinating movement in my nature writing world that happens kind of the generation before me. Wendell Berry epitomizes it in terms of having, you know, he's in New York City in his mid-20s and everybody's saying, you've got to stay here and make it big and be a big writer. And he says, nope, I'm going home to Kentucky. And they all say, you can't go home again. And he goes home, and that becomes his career, is writing about the place he's returned to. And Scott Russell Sanders had a book called Staying Put. And in many ways, they're children of Stegner. We think of them as children of Thoreau, but they're also children of Stegner.
I wanted to ask you about this question, and we'll work through this as we go. But you say, would Stegner or Abbey, would they be surprised at what the West has become?
And I think emphatically not.
Right.
I mean, what they would be surprised. I mean, they wouldn't have. I mean, it took a lot of us a while to get on the climate change bus. And that's a horrible mixed metaphor of the bus that's spewing CO2.
Right.
But I think one of the ways it fits. One of the ways it doesn't fit, like Abby's thinking, is the need to fight for a place you love, often a local place, and kind of screw the consequences to some degree and make a stand. And one thing that climate change and climate change thinking tends to do to us is it doesn't give us an interesting enemy. You know, when Ed Abbey's raging against the dams and developers and, you know, and putting sugar in bulldozers in the gas tanks, you know, he's fighting something that can kind of excite us. And I think that's one of Abbey's great gifts. He excites our imagination. So this idea of like this uber problem of climate change can really kind of send us shriveling into a corner. It would fit Stegner's thinking a little better. One of my favorite quotes, I think I use it too often in the book, is largeness is a lifelong matter, right, which is what Stegner said. He thought big. He thought not just emotionally big. He thought as a magnanimous person, but he thought in terms of, you know, I say he was the master at the children's game of connecting the dots. Mm-hmm. So right now, what would he connect? He would connect the dying forests, the beetles, the reduced snowpack. I have a new friend who just went out with a snow surveyor in the Sierra Nevadas, and the friend said that the surveyor had never seen it that low since 1977, and it was at 60% of what he'd seen it then. And what a lot of Easterners don't know is that the snowpack is everything. You know, it's what holds, and you know, snow as opposed to rain, as I say in the book, snow is a time release system onto itself, whereas rain pours and rolls off. Mm. So, you know, this is the other kind of thing that Stegner was always thinking about. He was thinking in big terms, but also practically about what it meant to live in the West.
Well, one of the things you talk about that for, because this is one of the questions you ask, you know, what did it mean to be a Westerner for Stegner? And there were a couple of things that go to what you were just saying. Scale, of course, is big.
Mm-hmm.
And space. Talk about that.
Well, there's that moment, you know, it's really, for me, it was really fascinating. I hope it came off somewhat that way in the book. But, you know, in the second chapter called First Sight, I describe them both first seeing the West.
Yeah.
And for Abby, that's leaving the mountains where he had kind of a hillbilly existence near home, Pennsylvania, and hitchhiking west at 17.
Yeah.
And, you know, he describes it in typical Abby fashion as saying it was like seeing the Rockies was like seeing a naked girl for the first time. I mean, and he really fell for it. He fell in love with the place. So he came to the West, as many of us do, as I did certainly, as a newcomer convert, you know, and that's an archetypal Western movement. Stegner had always lived in the West. And like a lot of people, you can't see the place you're in until you leave it. I mean, I, for instance, left New England at 30 and suddenly started to realize it had been a land of kind of SAT scores and Ivy League colleges and like these things I hadn't really known because I'd always lived in them like water. So Stegner goes into school in Iowa. And then when he's driving back, he suddenly notices the colors being less green and more sere and more the towns farther apart and the rise and fall of the land. And, you know, he says, the West always faces you like a dare. And he starts defining it mm-hmm. as he comes back and sees it again, kind of a rebirth. And, you know, he notices people spend more time outside in the West.
Right.
He notices all sorts of things he hadn't noticed living there at first.
This is reflected in one of those climactic scenes from Big Rock, Candy Mountain.
Yes.
Too, the sense of seeing it like that. Mention that because that that's an important book, I think, to read.
Yeah,
to
well, that's the first time, you know, these ideas would stay with him through many books and into the later essays where he really kind of distills them. But the first moment where we really get them is that ending. Now, of course, it's a novel, not a work of nonfiction, so he's not preaching these things. But he has the young character, based on himself, starting to notice the West and feel the West. And he says, you know, I never knew where home was because he moved around all the time as a kid. But maybe my home is the West itself, the larger West. Maybe I am a Westerner. And then he says, as he will say in different ways throughout his career, I may not know who I am, but I know where I'm from.
You know, it's so interesting. You mentioned that he almost stayed. Stegner. in Salt Lake City, liked it here. He worked at the linoleum and floor covering spot.
Yeah.
He liked he liked Mormon culture for the most part. He got along, you know, he played basketball with the Mormons in the ward houses. He really liked it here. And if it wasn't for a professor who thought he could, you know, get this gig in Iowa, he may have stuck around.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and of course, what he liked so much, you know, was, in a word, sharing.
Yep.
He liked being part of a community, finally, after, you know, having basically lived in what was the remnant frontier, like in Saskatchewan in the middle of nowhere with just his brother. And so he found a place where he fit, and he liked that, exactly. But, you know, I wonder if that's entirely true, even though I wrote it, because something else was growing up in him, which was this. He had already started to write some stories and some pieces for the local paper. And, you know, one thing I tried to do with this book is, it's natural on radio shows and when I do newspaper articles to focus on the environmental issues. But one thing it is the story of two writers, or maybe three if you throw me in.
Yeah.
But two writers becoming writers. So I think something was happening there to him. And then when he got the opportunity, boom, he was off to the races, because one of the defining characteristics of Stegner, and one of the things that drew me to him, and I think I say at one point, it was kind of like he was a savior for me. He was an unrepentant workaholic. Mm-hmm. In Crossing to Safety, which is a great book that takes place, a lot of it, in Vermont, but he kind of travels from the West through his career to Vermont. He describes his monthly output as a young man, like when he's 24. And, you know, I finished a novel, I wrote six short stories, I taught eight classes, and on and on. And then in an interview, he said, "That was actually a lot less than I really did. I just didn't want it to seem unrealistic."
You know, right.
He was just working and working. And, you know, and not to say Abby was a slouch. He certainly wasn't. He was the author of many books.
But you know what? When you're mentioning that, when you just that contrast between Abby and Stegner, because you write a bit about this. I mean, there's this image of you mentioned a river trip. A river trip that they both took. And on one hand, you have Stegner, who thinks, wouldn't have minded staying on the river trip, liked it. Of course, it was beautiful. He was taken by it. But he thought, this is a perfect place to write a book.
Exactly.
Abby, on the other hand, just wanted to sit back, have a beer, and just melt into it. That to me was a big contrast between those two writers.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. To me, that's really exciting. Abby actually said he'd like to strip naked, live there for a year, hunt deer, and, you know, which is kind of what he did during the Havasu chapter of Desert Solitaire. And I really think that the appeal of Abby, particularly now, you know, we're just charging from our email to our phone to wherever, is this guy who, at least on the pages of his book or books, is a master of the art of lounging, of kicking back and watching cloud formations and appreciating where he was. Now, it was a little more complicated in real life.
Sure.
In fact, he was fond of Churchill's phrase, bloody peace, because he knew that when we have all the time to kick back, our minds can sometimes start working against us. Stegner worked. That's what he did.
Yeah. David Gessner is with us. This book is called All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey Wallace Stegner and the American West. We need to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking to the nature writer David Gessner about his new book. It's called All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. Gessner is wondering if Abbey and Stegner, he mentions this in the book, weren't outdated given the new challenges for the new West, you know, climate change, energy development, but as he's been talking about, he thinks they're even more relevant today. I wanted to ask you, you have this really interesting exchange, kind of enigmatic exchange, I have to say, with the writer Terry Tempest Williams. You go to Castle Valley as part of your journey, and you have this exchange with her that is, I still don't know what to quite make of it, because it's almost this cryptic thing she says to you, and she right. says something that seems entirely counterintuitive about Wallace Stegner and Edward Abbey, and she says, Ed was the conservative, Wally was the radical. Talk about that.
Right. Well, as soon as she said it, I started to chew over it, but I also knew it was good for the book. You know, just from a, you know, because not only was I traveling around the West to all these spots and camping and hiking and biking and going on river trips, I was playing a little bit of a game of three-level chess in terms of knowing where in, like when I went to the Glen Canyon Dam, what threads of biography would I slide in about Stegner and Abbey? What would I do where? But also being open to what actually happened. And one of the things that happened is I got this, what I called a koan of, from Terry Tempest Williams. And it kind of went with my thinking in a way already. But as I started to chew on it, I did see some elements. For instance, I mentioned earlier about Wendell Berry deciding to go home again to Kentucky. Well, in our rootless society, that's somewhat of a radical move. And Stegner, in his old-fashionedness almost, his real fierce commitment to things like home and mate and place, was somewhat radical, even though he abhorred the word radical. And during the 60s, really grew sick of Stanford and the radicals who were ascendant. As, you know, and he was closing in on 60 himself, so it was a bad match at that moment. Abbey, on the other hand, was radical. You know, some people think, I mean, some people don't get how at core radical politically Abbey was. Mm-hmm. I mean, he grew up with a dad who was, you know, cried when the Soviet Union fell. I mean, and a dad who in his rural Pennsylvania town would make leftist, you know, really bold statements that obviously had an effect on his son's ability to make bold statements, and who really believed in monkey wrenching and in, you know, what now would probably land him in jail in our post 9/11 world, you know, in environmental sabotage. And so he was radical in that sense. But, you know, we know of his famous tirades against immigration, his toting of the gun. Mm-hmm. I think Terry, I don't want to speak for her, if she can call in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think as far as at least his early years, the way he was with women wasn't the most liberated mind in the world, though he did ultimately, with his fifth wife, he did start to commit and prove to be a good dad. So, you know, it's kind of like he was a conservative in that sense. And Stegner's radicalism was in just kind of taking these old virtues and values and sticking by them. So I like to say, as I was writing, that they contained each other, you know.
Yeah.
On the surface, they couldn't be more opposite. We mentioned the river trips before, but all you got to do is look at their hairstyles. And you've got right. the white coiffed Stegnerian, you know, never a hair out of place. And then you have wild, shaggy Ed. And so it was a fun game to play. But in any game like that, we oversimplify. So that added a kind of subcurrent where I kind of showed that they had other parts to each other or held other parts.
Well, one of the things you get to in the book also is this idea of which approach then, not to say one is one pole of the other, but they had decidedly different approaches, certainly, to many things. And which then is the right approach going right. forward for the, you know, for the environmental challenges that we're facing in the New West. And there's this moment where you write about how Edward Abbey once rolled this car tire down the Grand Canyon.
Right.
Just to see what would happen. Would you explain why he did that? And because you say in some way you kind of understood that impulse and his resistance to this moralizing and this sort of, you know, pious sense of environment.
Right,
this
right.
is something you yourself have written about, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this kind of goes back to our conversation about my Green Manifesto in a way. You know, Abby was a young guy. Yeehaw! You know, I mean, were we without our own environmental consciousnesses? I mean, I think I hate to admit it. I think I threw a frisbee down when I was 17. You know, it's kind of a boyish thing to do. Later, he would toss the beer cans out of the car and say it's the highway that's ugly.
Yeah.
But and a lot of it wouldn't fly now. But I think the fundamental thing that it does. I mean, I say in the book, it doesn't get us off the hook because nobody should get off the hook at this point. But it shows us that hypocrisy and sloppiness can be part of this, that we get this notion of environmentalism, which is, you know, it's very boring and it's schoolmarmy and it's like, you should do this. And after a few shoulds, we most of us rebel against that. So to quote Dan Driscoll, who's the Charles River, the greener of the Charles River, who we talked about in My Green Manifesto, he said, we need more hypocrites who fight. We're all hypocrites, but we need hypocrites who fight. So I held up Abby as that, as an impure environmentalist, which a lot of people have said before. I mean, that's not particularly new. But it's exciting to me because it, you know, what if I say, you know, it's kind of the Al Gore argument. Oh, he's got a big house, therefore he shouldn't say anything about climate change. We all have our big houses or our equivalent of that, our Achilles heels. So he frees us up to fight. And I'd say that the thing that Abby offers most now too, particularly to young readers, is he makes it kind of sexy and fun to fight the bad guys, you know, and that's important because why do you at 16 or 17 decide to go into something? Because you're excited about it and passionate. So that's what he kind of brings to the table right now, among other things, you know.
It's interesting. I have to say, for all your travels in the West in your life, you had never, is it true you had never really come to Salt Lake City before 2012?
It is true, yeah. And I loved it.
Yeah, you did love it. I mean, you kind of unabashedly loved it. And I wanted to ask you about that because, of course, for Stegner, Salt Lake City was, as you put it, a kind of salvation for him, attracted to certain aspects of Mormonism, liked the image. Of the beehive, for example.
Yeah, yeah, he did like the beehive. you know, he didn't like other sorts of sharing. He wasn't a big polygamy fan, but he did like the basic notion that to tackle agriculture in the dry West, community, not rugged individualism, was the way to go. So I think, you know, he actually got a lot of flack too from Mormons about his books about Mormon culture, but he was pretty balanced. For me, yeah, most of my time in the West was spent in Colorado with forays into Canyonlands and that part of the world, which, you know, pretty typical Colorado approach. And so when I drove into Salt Lake, I was like, oh my God, it's rung by mountains. And it's, you know, it was a beautiful winter day. And well, the first time was a beautiful summer day. And then I came back in the winter. And as I say in the book, I got together for a beer, and I had the whole trip. I had my bike on the back of the car, so I went to my room, which was at the university. It was the university guest house, and I biked down to meet the writer Stephen Trimble, who biked up to meet me there. And he was leaving town the next day. And it was very nice of him to even meet with me. But before we finished, after we finished our beers, and before we said goodbye, he biked me up to the graveyard where the Stegners were buried, or at least where.
His mom and brother were
father,
buried.
Brother and mother were buried. Yeah. And I walked over there and in the book, I'm going to get the book's name wrong now. I can't believe it. But somebody help me call in. But in the basic follow-up to Big Rock Candy Mountain, the Stegner character who is now, an ambassador comes back to Salt Lake and buys a grave to mark the father's unmarked grave. The father's grave had been unmarked next to the mother and son's. So I went over there and Stephen left me there. And there it was, the mother's grave, the brother's grave, but the father's grave was still unmarked. In other words, there had been no great moment of, you know, of kind of epiphany for Stegner. He had left the father's grave unmarked.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, all through his life, as magnanimous and great a man as he was he always wrestling with that deep dislike to the point of hate of his father, who was a bully, you know, and a pushy guy, but he could never quite come to grips with it. And that's what the Salt Lake chapter is a lot about.
Recapitulation, by the way. This part of the book, though, this part of the story is really interesting because, of course, George Stegner is involved in this kind of notorious murder-suicide. He kills himself, and Stegner consciously really endeavors to make himself, as you say, against the image of his father. He would be strong where his father was weak. He would be steady where his father was inconsistent.
Yep. The last words his mother says are, "You're a good boy, Wallace."
Yeah.
You know.
But you say that he still found himself a creature of this male culture that he was trying to get away from. I mean, there's this moment where you say he even found himself resisting intellectual conversation.
That's one of my favorite quotes of Stegner's.
Talk about that.
Well, it's just great. He knows he's up in Saskatchewan in this schoolhouse where they're teaching them European history, basically. But he's so hungry for books that he just gobbles everything down. And, you know, he's a little kid at this point. He's like 9 years old. And his brother is a natural athlete. He's a jock. And he's a natural thinker and writer and reader. And he is in a society that has no respect for those attributes. So he's kind of finding himself as this intellectual, this young kid intellectual, but also kind of trying to hide it. Because, you know, if in a tough guy society where words are few and where being macho is valued, what good is it to have read, you know, 20 books and memorized 20 chapters, which is what he would do. And that continued in him even as an adult where, you know, he didn't like, what did he call the mouthy people? Yeah. He didn't like glib, you know, because he was part intellectual, but he was also part a product of the frontier.
You went to visit Ken Sanders' bookshop to get his impressions on both Stegner and Abbey. He knew them both, of course.
Well, you say impressions. That's kind of funny because he doesn't mean, you got to get him on to do it, but he doesn't mean an Abbey impression. And he does it by keeping his bottom jaw completely still. And he talks like this from in here. And it's really funny to hear their actual voices. You know, Abbey's is gurgly and low down. And then Stegner, who you know, he grew up, as we've been describing, running around the West, and he sounds like William F. Buckley. Yeah. He's so refined. You know, it's like he's done the same thing with his voice that we just described him doing in Salt Lake City. He'd kind of reacted against where he was from.
Yeah, like the patrician voice. But it's interesting you say to Ken Sanders, you ask him to play the parlor game of comparing the two men's work. And Ken is on this program from time to time talking about books, talking about writers. Explain a little bit about what he told you, because he said that Stegner appreciated nature from this academic background. Abbey, I think he put it this way, celebrated wilderness for the sheer hedonistic thrill of it. I liked that comparison too.
Yeah. Ken and I can hash this out on Friday, but I don't entirely agree about Stegner.
Yeah.
It is true that his thinking is overarching and big, and I guess you could call that academic. And he doesn't do what our current, you know, like what I tried to do in that book, which is be a character who's actually doing the paddling and splashing along and the biking and meeting the people. You know, it's not creative nonfiction as we know it now. Right. But I still think it can be kind of visceral. He knew the West in his bones. But Abbey, you know, I go into a whole chapter where I talk about the history of the personal essay, which he was a personal essayist, or as Wendell Berry called him, an autobiographer, as much as he was a so-called nature writer. But that tradition from Montaigne in the 1500s to the present, where you create a self on the page. And he was great at it. He was great at having those contradictions. I mean, anyone who reads him will know, you know, in one sentence, he's looking at the shining light coming down through a juniper's gnarled branches. And in the next, he's telling a joke that could be on a bumper sticker. And then in the next, he's, wandering off and throwing a rock at a rabbit as he did in Desert Solitaire. And so you get this feeling, And it's just a feeling, because we're writers, we have to create this, mm-hmm. that you're dealing with a real complicated human being. And I think that's really the thrilling part. And when we played that parlor game and ranked them, neither of us could really dislodge Desert Solitaire from the top spot of, you know, of their books. I mean, for me, Desert Solitaire is the top of the mountain. And then I would probably put three or four works by Stegner, including Beyond the 100th Meridian and Angle of Repose, below it. But before I got back to Abbey, though, I will say that the kind of the essay collections by Abbey, which there were so many as he was kind of cashing in on his fame, are still some of my favorite books. You know, because we're no longer, there are very few essay collections anymore. New York doesn't like them, you know. They don't sell enough. But an essay collection can really give that kind of flavor of the person who created them. And I think he did just an amazing job at that.
Well, you say
he's one of our great essayists.
Is the work that keeps Edward Abbey really alive in many ways, at least for you, the essays. And I guess we should say this. I mean, you say that on some level, in some of his books, Monkey Wrench Gang in particular, Hey Duke Lives is another one, seemed over time to you to become, and this sounds like heresy, but a little silly, you say, a little dated, little one-dimensional, even.
Yeah, I think we all are allowed our opinions on this,
yeah.
And I'm getting ready. You know, I leave on school ends for me on Wednesday here in North Carolina, and as you've been saying, I speak Friday night at Ken's store, and I'm getting ready for a month in the West, and I'm sure I'm going to be in some very polite arguments about my take on Ed, because there are many defenders of the flame of Ed. You know, he's still followed and fought for, to use another F, fiercely. And he, you know, for me, when I loved the fiction was like the beginning of the book Black Sun, where the ranger wakes up and goes out and takes a leak and the birds are, I guess I liked the fiction when it was more like the nonfiction.
Yeah.
The cartoony fiction didn't have as big an appeal for me, though I will say that rereading Monkey Wrench Gang, I had a lot of fun reading it. And, it's just, it didn't seem to me at the absolute top level. And one thing I'll say, one of the reasons for writing the book is I don't feel like in the literary establishment, the Eastern literary establishment, these guys are given the place they deserve, which is absolutely at the top as far as I'm concerned. And for me, to put Abbey at the top, I have to go with his nonfiction. Stegner, I would, you know, The Angle of Repose and Beyond the 100th Meridian really put him up there for me.
David Gessner is with us. His new book is called All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. We'll take another quick break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the writer David Gessner. We're talking about his new book, All the Wild That Remains. It's interesting, David Gessner, this, and I hadn't realized this. I'm not sure if I had ever seen this anywhere, but you mentioned the Wallace Stegner kind of reacting to the Ken Keseys, the Ed Abbeys. These were all students of his, of course, kind of the reactionaries, the radicals at Stanford. Didn't really abide by them in many ways, and that's one of the things that you write about. He had this very clear moral code, and he wouldn't abide when people violated it. I mean, you tell the story about the divorce of a very close friend, and he didn't talk to the man for years after that. And you ask this question in the book. You say, do any of us get beyond the boundaries of the selves that we start with? Would you say something about that?
Well, I think Stegner believed that we can. I mean, we're always pulled back to our basic raw material. But in his efforts to kind of grow, he, like all of us, was kind of, you know, growing and then pulled back. And one of the things he didn't like about the Keezys of the world was he didn't like writing that, as he said, throbbed rather than thought. You know, he didn't, you know, he would have had, if he read a line of it, he would have rolled his eyes at On the Road. You know, he did not like the whole notion of throwing over society. You know, he liked culture. He had grown up without culture on the equivalent of the frontier. The frontier was dead, but what he lived was close to a frontier life. And he admired and held culture up. So when he saw the 60s come along and culture was being thrown down, he was outraged by it. So there was always that going on. Of course, Abby, on the other hand, you know, I quote Thoreau in the book and say, the life that men regard and call successful is but one kind. Abby was a great embracer of that other kind, of the counter life. And for me, these two kind of poles bring up really the personal aspect of the book. Originally, I called it Properly Wild. And it's not a great title, but it really gets at what I was, my question, my kind of driving personal question was, is it possible to be good and wild, you know, to have that kind of loyalty to wife and family and you know, spouse and family, and, you know, try to be a good man in your day-to-day life, but have an appreciation of wildness and of a counter life and occasionally saying, screw it.
Yeah.
So how can you be both those things? And it's funny because after I finished writing the book and was completely done with it, I found out that there had been a book by John L. Thomas about called Country in the Mind that was about DeVoto and Stegner. And in it, he quotes André Malraux as saying, biography is a means of expression when the author has chosen his subject in order to respond to a secret need in his own nature. And I feel like, you know, one of the reasons I was doing this book, obviously there were external reasons, but one internal reason was these guys spoke to parts of me and that have always been kind of at war. And I wondered if this reading those two could help them kind of make some peace.
Gosh, there's an interesting aside. You also mentioned that Ken Kesey's book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that the character of Nurse Ratched may have in some way, in part, you know, rigid and clenched, was in some way meant to be Wallace Stegner in part?
Well, I think it's in a footnote, and or maybe it was in the book itself in the final draft, but I'm quoting an academic who suggests this. I don't know if I buy that entirely,
yeah. But
I do buy the fact that Kesey said when he pushed off in his, you know, psychedelic bus further, he said part of the reason that we're going on this trip, this LSD-fueled trip, is because Wally doesn't want us to, and that's reason enough. And, you know, and he also said Wally drank Jack Daniels while I took LSD, and that's our split. So, you know, you've got this craziness exploding with the Merry Pranksters, and Ed McClanahan, who's a Merry Prankster, is Wallace Stegner's office mate, and this is exploding all around him. And, you know, it's kind of Stegner's worst nightmare in
yeah,
a way.
Yeah.
But what you have to say about it is it released great energies, creative energies, and made some amazing art. But
yeah,
it's not Stegner's kind of art.
You explore the condition of monkey wrenching in a post 9/11 world.
Yeah.
He had this interesting conversation with a former FBI agent in Grand Junction, which I think gave a sort of a new perspective on what monkey wrenching is these days.
Well, a lot of us who are, I'm 54, and I'm sure a lot of the people I'm going to see during my book tour are, you know, my age or older, and we romanticized the old school Abbey sort of monkey wrenching, and that really hinged on secrecy, on kind of, you know, you go out with one other person or two at most, you do a little, you know, you cut down a billboard or you do something like that, and then you don't tell anybody, and Tim DeChristopher, the environmentalist, said to me, when secrecy was the main part of that sort of monkey wrenching, you know, it was great for its time, but it also allowed others to create a narrative out of it. And of course, the big narrative created out of it in our post 9/11 world is these are terrorists. These are, you know, these are, they're destroying things. They should be regarded as terrorists. Whether you reject that or not, I have said, and I've had a lot of blowback about this, but, you know, Abbey would not, you know, Abbey would land in jail if he was doing what he was doing in the 70s now. But what's interesting as far as a new, and this is talking to the FBI agent, a new possibility about monkey wrenching is go the opposite route, make it public, you know, film it. We brought up whale wars as an example, you know, take control of the narrative, film the destruction of land with somebody, you know, narrating, use the reality show kind of way. So we were just starting to brainstorm on how it could, monkey wrenching could kind of come back to life. Because the key thing about monkey wrenching, it seems to me, is the importance of symbol, you know, whether it's the monkey wrench itself or the drawing of the crack on the Glen Canyon Dam, anything that stirs through symbol. And I think that is still a possibility, even if trashing a bulldozer maybe is going to land you in jail.
It's interesting you say that you raise the question of whether, you know, that monkey wrenching approach. You write this, you say, the more you read Ed Abbey, the more you started to see him as a creature of his particular time, a time as distant from ours as Daniel Boone's was from his. But you think if they harness that power of a symbol, if that's done, you think in that sense, Abbey can still be relevant today.
Well, it's already being done. You know, Christopher bid on the oil leases in Utah. I mean, he ended up in jail in Denver for 2 years because he took the, you know, the land out of the oil company's hands. But he did something that stirred people and got people excited. So it's already being done. What I meant by Abbey being a creature of his time, it kind of goes back to our earlier thing about Kesey. That period of the 60s and early 70s that saw Desert Solitaire and some of the other books and Monkey Wrench Gang also was the time of Hunter Thompson. It was the time of Kesey. It was the time of, you know, anything goes and freedom being extolled above all else. We're not in the same time right now. And it's hard to believe that some of Abbey's statements and Abbey's ways would be embraced the way they were then. It was the right cresting moment, you know. Hunter Thompson, for instance, if I handed in a piece that was Hunter Thompson-esque right now to my various magazines I work for, I don't think they'd be running it.
Huh. Does that make you sad?
A little bit. I mean, a little bit what the book is it's there's a nostalgia for me, you know.
Yeah.
I was born in 61, so I didn't see the 60s at their peak, but I did, you know, for me, that was a great releasing of energy, too. It was a time where I was very excited and starting to write. And I'm talking now about the 70s, which, as I say in the book, were kind of a remnant 60s in a way that people don't really appreciate. So a little bit sad. And that's, again, that's with the properly wild. Is it possible, for instance, to kind of reinstill that sort of wildness in our lives? And I know a lot of people are doing it on an individual basis, but it seems to me that culturally we have moved away from it.
Let me ask you, I want to ask you finally, this is something you mentioned, that you took these, I don't know if they were lessons, but these imprints of the West, and you took them back to Cape Cod, and you took them back to North Carolina, and that became sort of a template in some ways for you. Explain how that works now. How are you using the template of the West for your life in North Carolina, for example?
Well, you know, I think what I was talking about, and I'll start with Stegner, were habits of thought, you know, and large habits of thought, always connecting things, you know, as he did with aridity and our use of dams and our reliance on the government. You know, like as I say at one point, the West was a rugged and beautiful welfare state, you know, and that Stegner was one of the first to recognize that. So when I first went back to Cape Cod, I saw it for the tourist environment it was and the sandy soil it had. And in the years since, as I took a job in North Carolina and have been a mover, unlike, you know, more in the Abbey manner than the Stegner manner of kind of rooting down in one place, I started to see that the hurricanes that I was studying, I do a lot of writing about coastal development and hurricanes, how the rebuilding of the houses and the cries, the patriotic cries to rebuild along the shore was a lot like that in the foothills after fires in Colorado. And then, as we mentioned earlier in the conversation, when I went down to the Gulf during the oil spill, suddenly I was connecting that to a lot of Stegnerian ideas about resource colonies. And I saw, I started to triangulate with these things and saw how my coastal world was attached to my old Western stomping grounds and was attached to the Gulf. And it really kind of, you know, we get regionally proud. And for instance, I'm sure some people are saying, why is this guy from North Carolina writing this book about the West? But by getting to know three or four places pretty well and learning the birds and the plants and the trees, I feel like I'm starting to know the country pretty well. In fact, I almost took a job in the Midwest a few years ago. And if I had, then I'd have them all down, you know, all the regions. But the, you know, like flying into Wilmington, North Carolina and seeing how flat it is and how close the water is, you know, it's a little like flying into above the West, like I did above Vernal, and seeing just how dry the land it is and how easily scarred it is. So it's just starting to make these connections, and Stegner was the master.
David Gessner. His new book is called All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner in the American West. David Gessner, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.